Finally, the beautiful weather's here, right? Anyone wagering on more snow? No? Wouldn't that be, yeah, wouldn't that just be, ugh. That'd be devastating to the morale. We're back into our domestic series. This morning, over the course of 6 weeks, we're looking at the spirituality of every day. Finding faith in the mundane and domestic aspects of our lives. And I want to focus on an aspect of our days that I think so often gets overlooked, and that's storytelling. Storytelling. Anthropologists tell us that storytelling is it's central to human existence. It's common to every known culture in our world and throughout history. In fact, one of the very first things that children learn to navigate as they grow and develop is storytelling. Humans have been telling stories for thousands of years, even before the written word, passing along stories through an oral tradition. And so, in one way or another, much of our lives are spent telling stories, listening to stories, watching stories, reading stories. I mean, consider an average day. You go to work, you tell stories to your coworkers about what you did the night before, you come home, somebody asks you, how was your day, which is code for, tell me a story about your day. Then you sit down and you eat dinner and you tell stories around the dinner table. Then after dinner, you log on to Facebook to see what story people are telling about themselves. And then you watch TV and hear stories. Maybe at night you read a book, you read other stories. Humans are the storytelling animal, you could say. We do it each and every day. And I find that to be so fascinating because while stories make up so much of our lives, I think rarely do we sort of stop to consider, what does it all mean? Why do we tell stories? What is going on below the surface? Well, what I want to do this morning is this. First, I want to tell a few stories along the way. It'd be weird to do a thing on stories without stories. But I want to share with you, I think, three reasons why I believe we tell stories as humans. Then I want to relate those three storytelling reasons, those explanations to why I think Jesus asked us to tell his story with a particular ritual, the ritual of Eucharist communion. So that's the direction we're heading. But why do we tell stories? I think underneath it all, I believe we tell stories as humans for three reasons. Because we're all trying to make sense of the world, because we all long for a shared history, and because we all want to matter. Let me expand on those a little bit. Why do we tell stories? Well, we tell them to help make sense of the world. Neuroscientists tell us that our brains are hardwired to detect patterns in the visual forms of nature. And by learning to detect patterns, it saves the brain a whole lot of work. And so that's why, for instance, consider a young child. A young child will instantly recognize a dog. And so it begins to learn patterns over time that help it realize this is a dog. So a child might come across a chihuahua, for instance, a little bit of a weird dog. And though it looks drastically different from a German shepherd, the first time a child sees a chihuahua, it very easily recognizes that's a dog. Dog, dog, dog. And when you think about it, it's actually a quite remarkable achievement of the mind to recognize these patterns. And in a similar way, I think you could say this, stories provide recognizable patterns for us. And in those patterns in life, we find meaning. Stories help us make sense of the world because they provide these patterns of meaning. I also believe this is why framing the Christian faith as story is so incredibly helpful. When I say Jesus experienced death and resurrection, it's not hard to relate that pattern to our own stories because many of us have experienced at some point in life an area, a time where we felt like we died to something and experienced new life after. And so the patterns inherent in stories allow people to see chaos, see meaning amidst chaos, amidst seeming randomness. Humans are inclined, in fact, to see stories everywhere. There's this famous test done in 1944. I find it fascinating. It was conducted by Fritz Heider and Marianne Simmel at Smith College. And what happened is 34 students were shown a video clip, and what it had was these shapes on it. And, you know, my little rectangle got cut off the side there. But the rectangle on the right stayed stationary, and the other three shapes, the two triangles and the circle, they moved around, sort of randomly. So 34 college students were shown this, and then they were asked after the short video, what did you see? And 33 of the 34 students anthropomorphized what they saw, the shapes. And so the responses came in. What did you see? One person reported that the circle looked worried. Somebody said that the little triangle was such an innocent young thing. One other person wrote that the big triangle, though, appeared to be blinded by rage and frustration, so imagine moving that around and reading in. Wow, that big triangle is blinded by rage and frustration. That cracks me up. Of the 34 students, only one student said, oh, I just saw shapes. That's it. Humans see stories even in the abstract, and by doing so, it allows us to make sense of an incredibly chaotic and complex world. And this is why, you know, we've just come through Jesus' parables. I truly believe this is why Jesus told so many stories. I believe he knew that some things were so complex, they could only be explained through stories. And so in a world that's sort of hard to understand, we tell stories to give life meaning and purpose. We tell stories to help make complexity relatable. When I left Grandview, they had some people put together some cards, just some farewell cards for me, and people related their memories of my time at Grammy. It was interesting. Kristen and I were flipping through them that evening, and the vast majority of people would say things like, "Oh, we're gonna miss you, Brad. I remember this story you told. Remember the story you told about cleaning the shower, or I remember the story you told. Story." And Kristen, we got toward the end of the card, and Kristen said, does it bother you that nobody seemed to remember any of your points from teaching? They all sort of said, remember a story? I remember thinking at the time, no, not at all. Why? There's so much complexity and information in the world, it doesn't bother me that people remember stories, because we're storytelling animals. That's what we remember. Or think about funerals and weddings. You ever been at a funeral, or have you ever given the eulogy at a funeral? It's an incredibly difficult task, because you go, how do you sum up a life in a few minutes? And what happens at funerals? Without fail, it turns to storytelling. It's impossible to sum up the complexity of somebody's life by stating some facts. Well, they worked here. Eventually, it turns to, let me tell you a story. And this story will help you understand the complexity of this person's life. Or at weddings, I mean, I love speeches at weddings. I live for speeches at weddings, because inevitably they get weird and awkward, right? Which is the best. I love it. Love it. And what happens at weddings as well? How do you sum up the complexity of relationship and love? And what ends up happening is people tell stories. Let me tell you a story to sum up the complexity of this relationship. Stories make sense of the complexity. The things we remember deeply in life are stories. Stories. That's why I truly believe, again, the Christian faith is best understood as a story, not as a set of dogma or set of beliefs, but an incredible story worth giving our lives to. And it's also why I think storytelling, whether through massive films or books or television shows, right down to the mundane stories we tell around the dinner table, they're not just ways to pass time. They're not just a byproduct of language or communication. No, they are the ways that we communicate meaning in life. Second, though, I think we tell stories to find a shared history. We tell stories as humans because we want to be part of a shared history. Why did everyone jump on the Blue Jays bandwagon last year? I mean, why did those of us, and I'll count myself in as one of those, I hadn't watched baseball in 20 years, and suddenly I was the biggest fan, right, in the world. Why did everybody sort of start jumping on? You say, well, because the Jays were winning. That's new, right? But there's something deeper there, right? I think what people sensed is that collectively we sensed some sort of historic story was unfolding, and everybody wants to be part of that. And so now, right, you go, where were you in Game 5? When Jose Bautista flipped his bat, and we all just were like, yeah. I mean, we all have stories about that, right? Or remember the time at Nexus where instead of doing church, we watch Canada win the gold medal in the Olympics and how awesome that was, right? Why did we do that? Because we realized there's history happening here, and we want to share in that. Part of me wants to really go down to Cleveland in July for the Republican convention because I sense there's some history about to happen there. I'm not sure I want to be caught in that history. I have a feeling it could get a little ugly, right? But part of me is like, oh, wouldn't that be fascinating? Or I was talking this morning to Chris about the show Better Call Saul. Why do people love talking to each other about stories and television shows? Because it's a shared history. Or when I say to you, where were you on 9/11? We know there's a kindred shared history there. For those of you a little bit older, where were you when the spaceship Challenger exploded? For those of you a little older still, where were you when JFK was assassinated? Or why do people get married? So they can share kind of boring stories with each other day after day that cumulatively amount to some sort of shared history together. I think there's something incredibly comforting about having a shared history. There's something profound about having witnesses to our own experiences. I mean, why do we gather week after week? So many reasons, you could say, to learn, to grow, to worship, to study Jesus, to form community. Yes, but beneath all those things, I think there's something deeper as well. We gather because we want to be part of a shared history. And so when I say to you, were you here at Easter and there was this crazy video and then the band did a song and then Eric walked up behind and then the silence of it launched into Christ the Lord is risen today and oh, the goosebumps, right? I want to say, hey, were you part of the 40 days? Were you following along with the 40 days? And did you catch some of Ruthie's reflections in there? You go, ah, yeah, shared history. Have you been at Glimpses before when Glenn was doing some sort of thing and he's, you know, there's guitars behind him and it's like, ah, that's awesome. Were you there when I brought in my urine? Right? Or dropped an F-bomb? Or how many of you were at the Benjamin's pool party and we were jumping off rocks into the pool? How many of you have been to one of the Griffins' wine parties and you've never tasted food and wine like that before? Because Jenny makes a crab mac and cheese and it's so delicious to make your mouth water. Why we gather week after week, event by event, teaching by teaching, story by story, we're developing a shared history together. You know, I think it's a legitimate response. If somebody ever asks you why you go to church and you're embarrassed to say because you're interested in faith, I think a legitimate response is because I'm forming a shared history with these people. The reason we experience things together and share stories together, tell them over and over again, is because as humans we want to be part of a shared history. And so how many of you have a family member, or maybe it's even me, and they've told you that story for the fifth time, and you're like, I've already heard this. But when we tell somebody else's story, it's a way of inviting them in to your shared history. And it's tremendously powerful. But finally, and perhaps, I think maybe most importantly, why do we tell stories? I think a lot of it comes down to mattering. We all want to matter. So when my daughter, Zoe, tells me a story about her pet unicorn and how it dug a hole in the sand to bake cookies that a dinosaur ate later, I sit there and I think, I have no idea what that was about. But when I listen intently to her story, it affirms for her that she actually matters to me. We tell stories because we want to matter. I think all of us want to be respected, esteemed, and of interest to others. And so we tell stories to achieve that end. We tell stories in the hopes of that others will come to see that our lives, our existence, it actually matters. When someone listens or takes interest in a story you share, it's a powerful affirmation. Our lives, they matter. I think this is why the Black Lives Matter campaign is so important. I think it's why sharing the stories of what's happening to our youth in Attawapiskat is important. Because if we want to truly value a person or people, if we want to truly communicate that a life matters, it means we need to listen, really. Listen to their story, their perspective, allow that to change us, shape us. And to have your story heard is such a powerful affirmation. Your life matters. I want to listen. We tell stories to matter. This whole idea of telling stories Because We Want to Matter was really driven home to me in a powerful way a number of years ago through a man I knew. His name was Brian. And I want to share with you some of Brian's stories because, A, I think they're funny. But B, more importantly, because they drive home this point in a profound way. You see, Brian was a compulsive liar. He lied about virtually everything. And after a few months of interacting with Brian, I was confiding to Chris, and I said, I don't know what to do with this guy at church. He just lies all the time about everything. I said, I don't know, should I call him out on it? Should I just ignore him and turn away? And I remember Kristen, in her wisdom, I remember her saying to me, changed the way I sort of saw Brian. I remember saying to me, Brad, listen to his stories. What is the harm in letting him tell these stories? He just wants to matter. Brian was in his mid-20s, barely 5 feet tall. He suffered from some kind of learning disability that meant he lived at home with his parents. He spent most of his time literally just walking around Kitchener, nothing to do. And after Kristen's comments, I began to realize something about Brian. It was this: in a world full of people who desperately want to matter, how does somebody like Brian, how does he matter when he has nothing in the way of things our culture believes is significant? What do you do if, like Brian, you don't have a great job or kids or spouse or interesting stories or money or smarts or Facebook and Instagram-worthy pictures of your holiday or vacation? What do you do if you have none of those? Brian's answer to this was, I'm going to make up stories. First encountered Brian, we were playing floor hockey. There was a men's floor hockey on Monday nights at Grandview, and so we'd play there. And Brian was such an interesting character because the way we had it is there was a middle line down the gym, and the defense could not cross that line until the offense did. And so Brian would grab the puck, and he'd just run in circles in his own zone before crossing over. And everyone would stand around going, what are you doing? And he became known as this guy at hockey that wasn't really good, but of course was clearly desperate for attention. It was kind of odd. But then the next time I sort of interacted with Brian on a one-on-one basis, I was walking up Fairview Road. I lived at the time, and I ran into Brian, and he was wearing a jacket that had FBI on the back. Ran into Brian, and I said, hey, Brian, what are you doing? He's like, I'm on a stakeout. I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, yeah, I'm working with the FBI. We've got some stuff going down in this area. And the thing about Brian is he was confident. Like, he never looked like he doubted the stories he was telling. And I'd say, FBI, what are you guys doing in Canada? Like, boom, right away. It's a cross-country investigation. The Mexican authorities are involved, too. We've got some drug problems in these areas. Really? And then he pauses, and he's like, yeah, Falcon, yeah, I'm in location here. Really? Nobody answered back. And he's like, at the end of the conversation, I'm like, okay, I don't know what to do with this. He's like, between you and me, Brad, I think you should just stay out of this area for a little while. And I did. I was going, okay. You see, in a world where walking around and doing nothing doesn't matter, Brian made up a story where he did matter and was concerned about my safety. Or there's a time we were up in Algonquin Park, a whole bunch of us young adults, we were sitting around the campfire, everybody was telling stories, adrenaline stories, I've gone rock climbing, I go surfing, all these things, and came around to Brian. Brian, what do you do? He said, I'm a professional wolf howler. He said, a wolf howler? He said, I don't want to go over the top here, I've taken a few courses, we can just leave it at that. Of course, sitting around with young adults, nobody was going to leave it at that. I said, really? Could you howl for us? And again, he was so quick and confident. He's like, is the food stored properly? Because if I do a wolf howl and they come, make sure everyone stays around the campfire. I'm like, I'm looking at these other young adults. I'm like, guys, don't egg them on, please. And they did. And he started howling. And I knew this was going to happen, but of course, one of the young adults snuck away into the woods and started howling back. And Brian's like, see, now I'm just going to calm down here because if I keep howling, they're going to get a whole lot closer. It's going to get real dangerous. So they sit there thinking, going, oh, man. You see, in a world where our lives matter based on how interesting and compelling your latest adrenaline rush was or the hobbies that you do, Brian made up a story. It was as interesting as it gets. Well, the time I was sitting around, I was talking with some young adults about their careers, everybody working their jobs. Somebody said, Brian, what do you do? Said, well, I'm an entrepreneur. I've just started my business lately, a night lawn mowing business. Not what? Really? What do you mean a night lawn mowing business? He's like, everybody mows the lawn during the day. We do it at night when everyone's sleeping. Oh, man. Of course, somebody's like, how do you see? And again, oh, we have flashlights on our lawnmowers. Don't people complain about the noise? No, it's fine. It's totally, people love it. They're like, just, oh. You're kidding. He was just so quick with his stories. You see, in a world where you matter based on your job or your profession, Brian made up a story that was incredibly far-fetched, but actually kind of entrepreneurial. There's part of me going, why don't people mow their lawns at night? So, well, the time Brian started feigning injuries. He would show up at hockey. One week he'd have a cast on this leg. Next week was up here. Always a story. Always a story behind it. But I remember one week we were short on hockey players. Brian came in on crutches. His leg was up like this. He had his hockey stick with him. Came in, sorry guys, I'm not going to be able to play tonight. Hurt my leg. He told the story. But we were short on players. And I remember one guy said to him, are you sure, Brian, you can't play? No. He said this line. So the guy said to him a line, and it completely changed everything. He said, Brian, are you sure we really need you? And I remember he walked out the doors, walked back in, no crutches, no cast, started running around the gym. Just, yeah, I'm ready to go. And all of us are like, what happened to your leg? I'm going to play through the pain. In a world where you matter based on how much you're needed, Brian feigned injuries until he was needed. Brian had nothing of what typically matters in our world, so he made it up. Brian had very little to praise himself about. Most of us, when we come to church or a social setting, we've got family or work or interesting stories to share with each other, but Brian, he didn't have any of that. So he made up stuff so he could participate in socializing with others, because he wanted to matter, just like the rest of us. And though his stories, of course, they didn't sort of jive, they didn't sort of fit with reality, what I learned was that Brian was really just like the rest of us. He wanted to matter. And the way you matter in life is by telling stories, so he told stories too. And sure, his stories were more transparently fake than the rest of ours, but we still use stories for the same reason Brian did, that's to matter. And, you know, we might be more subtle and socially nuanced with how we tell stories, how we exaggerate in stories, but it's all the same thing. We want to matter. For one person, it's wolf howling and jobs with the FBI, but for the rest of us, it's that degree we got, or the new phone, or the baseball stats, or the weekend away, the witty remark, the important work we do in the community, the latest gossip, the concert tickets, the new car, exotic travel plans, a promotion, clever ideas, but it's all the same. And behind it all, I believe, is a deep-seated insecurity we have as humans, a dread. If we're not noticed, if nobody's listening, then we're not worth anything. And so our stories are our way of saying, see me as interesting, see me as worthy of attention, I want to matter. And whether it's here in this community or beyond, I believe that behind every single set of eyes here this morning, behind every story we share, whether it's true or not, behind it all are people who just want to matter. And to be honest, at the end of the day, I'm not sure the content of our stories matters so much as the universal desire behind them to matter, to be seen, to be heard, to be valued. I think one of the greatest gifts we can give to anyone is to simply listen. You know, in a couple weeks' time, we're going to do glimpses and we're going to see and hear and read stories. I think one of the greatest gifts we can give to our community is to be here, to be present, to listen, to actually care about the content of other people's stories. We tell stories to matter. We tell stories to make sense of the world. We tell stories to find a shared history. And you know, interestingly enough, I think all three of these storytelling explanations, they relate actually to Jesus' desire to have his followers continue to tell his story. It's interesting, when you move through the Gospels and through Paul's writing, what becomes apparent is that for the earliest Christians, it was so important to retell Jesus' story. Because in the telling of Jesus' final meal and his death, it somehow seemed to speak to all of the hidden desires we have behind the stories we tell. Jesus wanted his followers to remember the story of his dying by retelling it through this ritual act of taking bread and taking wine. Paul explains, it's interesting because it started off as an oral tradition and makes its way into writing. So Paul tells that here and how the storytelling goes. He says, I received from the Lord that which I also delivered to you. The Lord Jesus, in the night in which he was betrayed, he took bread. When he had given thanks, he broke it and said, this is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me. In the same way, he took the cup also after supper, saying, this cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. For as often as you eat this bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. And so 2,000 years ago, this ritual retelling of Jesus' story began. And in retelling this story and ritually acting it out, it contains all of what we've talked about behind stories. By doing this, it gives us a shared history. It gives us a framing story through which to see the world, and it reminds each and every one of us that we matter. It gives us a shared history. You see, as we retell the story of Jesus' death, it allows us to sort of humbly take our place on this ancient Christian path, a path that has been traveled for more than 2,000 years. It continues to be traveled by millions today. And so it gives us a sense of shared history. We're not silos in history. We're part of a path. We're part of a tradition. It extends thousands of years. And so this ritual storytelling of Jesus' death, it reminds us of our place in history. It reminds us that we have a sense of belonging, not just here, but on a much wider spectrum. We have a shared history, a shared tradition. It allows us to sort of humbly take our place in this world, knowing we belong to a heritage. But second, in this ritual act, I think we do it because in this story, we are assured that we all matter. The reenacting of the story through bread and wine does something. It does something that affirms each and every one of our stories. It reminds us that we matter. Each and every one of us, we matter. See, I think the Eucharist ritual, the retelling of Jesus' story, it's the primary symbol in the Christian faith of unity, equality, and grace. And it has profound implications because by retelling Jesus' story here at Nexus, whether it's the Eucharist story or Jesus' stories altogether, it reminds us that in this community, everyone matters. Every single story matters here. It says this, we're all walking the same path. We're all equal. We are all worthy of respect and dignity. We are all in need of grace. The playing field is level. People who would never normally associate with one another sit together as equals. And so at Nexus, I believe, you know, we practice this. It's a subversive political act. As Richard Beck says, he says this, the retelling of Jesus' story announces that real people divided in the larger world have come together into a sweaty, intimate, flesh and blood embrace where there shall be no difference between us and the rest. By practicing this Eucharist, telling the story of Jesus, his body broken, his blood spilt as a demonstration. It's a demonstration of the way of love, way of grace. Everyone matters. Your story matters here. There are no second-class citizens here. Around this table, around this ritual, everyone's equal. All of us stand in need of grace. And amidst the sadness, the chaos, the struggle of this world, this ritual takes us to the heartbeat of God, which is grace, grace, grace. Well, finally, this story also gives us it's a framing story through which to see the world. my neighbor down the street, Heather and Matt, they have a son, Clark, who has type 2 pontocerebellar hypoplasia. It's a rare neurodegenerative disease. And Clark is almost 3. He's just a few months older than my son, Huxley. And he's always in the hospital. And there's a picture of him here. He's become a bit of a character in our neighborhood. Because he's always in the hospital. He can't move around on his own, can't speak. And Friday night, some Facebook posts started going out that Clark had been taken to the hospital. And it seemed worse this time around. And things weren't going well. And everyone in the neighborhood has sort of been touched by Clark's story. His dad likes skateboarding. And so sometimes he'll put Clark in a Jolly Jumper harness, and you'll see him skateboarding down the street with Clark. And our neighborhood association, we were able to get in our local park, we put in a swing, because Clark can't swing in the normal child swings that other children do, so we had one installed so that Clark could swing like other kids. And so you got this Facebook post that Clark wasn't doing well, and there were some difficult conversations going on. And then the post started to get a little bit more urgent, and there was a photo of Clark's dad holding him, asking Clark to stay just a little longer. And then on Saturday afternoon, it seemed like things were getting better, and Heather posted a photo of Clark's finger just inside of Heather's hand, and that Clark was struggling to hold on. And then late last night, parents, they posted, they said, it's the worst thing, a devastating decision for any parent to make. Say, we've decided to let Clark go, and we're moving into hospice care. And so a two-year-old is now in hospice care with a few days left to live. And I think of a story like that, and I go, I don't know. There's so many days, like the story of that film earlier with the triangles, where all I see is shapes and no sense of meaning or purpose. So many days when this world just seems chaotic and cruel and random and nothing more than a mess of incomprehensible happenings that just make no sense. In fact, a story like Clark's, Chris and I, we just sat weeping yesterday because, I mean, the reality is I don't know Clark or his family well, but it hits home. And you go, life sometimes, honestly, it just feels like it makes no sense. It's hard to see the beauty in it when stories like this happen. And I go, what? How do you make sense? How do you make sense of that? I'm not sure you do. I'm not sure you know how. But I think by retelling the Christian story, by ritually taking the bread and the wine, what we are declaring is that the framing story through which we as Christians see the world is this. Next slide. Revelation 21. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. They will be his people. God himself will be with them and be their God, and he'll wipe every tear from their eyes. And there will be no more death, or mourning, or crying, or pain. For the old order of things has passed away, and he who was seated on the throne said, I am making everything new. I have a lot of friends who are not, don't believe, don't have faith, and they would say, you know, your belief in this story, Brad, is completely made up. It's a way to make you feel better about the pain in the world, and you know what I say? Yeah. You know what? You might be right. You could be 100% completely right. But I choose to believe this. And maybe I just, I can't handle stories with sad endings. I don't know. But I think it takes courage to believe this. I think it takes courage to have hope in a world so filled with pain. I'm going to ask Murray, he's going to come and lead us through this Eucharist ritual, the band to come. But this, to me, is the framing story of the Christian faith. There is a day coming where there will be no more dying, no more pain, no more mourning, no more crying. And when we dip the bread into the wine, it's our bold and courageous declaration. While this world feels random and cold and chaotic so often, far too often, there is a story of hope. It's a story we put our faith in. It's the story we tell every time we gather. It's the story we declare through the bread and the wine. Murray?